Thank you very much. It's a deep privilege for me to be here, both as an Englishman among Americans. Is this on? Not at all. John, did you do something to it?
You have to speak closer to it, I think.
Is this on now? Great, it's okay. It's a real delight to be here, both as an Englishman among Americans and also as a layman among so many pastors. And also, I imagine, the way I was introduced last night, as the heaviest person in a week when you're partly here to be enriched and to enjoy yourselves. I hope I won't put you all to sleep. I remember when James Michener's Chesapeake was reviewed by Newsweek. They finished up a long review by saying, our best advice is don't read this book. And our next best advice is don't drop it on your toe. And I'm afraid that's the sort of books that I write. And it may well be the sort of way I talk too. But anyway, it's a delight to be here, genuinely. There are two incidents that are in the back of my mind as I try and share with you this morning. The first is the contrast in the last week before the cross of two incidents in Holy Week. On Palm Sunday, as Jesus wept over Jerusalem, it was all because they missed God's moment when it came. And he weeps because if only they had known the way that leads to peace, but they didn't. But then, as he went forward to the cross, he says to his disciples calmly, as he looks out to those who are arresting them, this is their moment, the hour when darkness reigns. One moment was God's moment, a moment that was packed full of opportunity and responsibility, and they missed it. And the next moment was their moment, the hour when darkness reigns. Now, clearly in Scripture, there are times when today is the day of salvation and there's an openness at any moment. And yet, both in the lives of nations and of individuals, there are particularly crucial periods that represent extraordinary opportunity, extraordinary responsibility, a deep sense of turning point. The second incident is in the history of my own nation, England. In 1830... Britain was the world's lead society. It was the time of the first industrial revolution that changed the face of history. And to be the world's lead society at such a moment was willy-nilly to affect the world. And in 1830, it was said by historians, evangelicalism was the single most decisive influence in Britain. Now, as you look back at that moment, there were some evangelicals from the highest levels down to the humblest levels who seized that moment. We think of the abolition of slavery, the founding of the Bible Society, and 100 other things they did. Some of them under God seized their moment. And because of where they were at that time, and Britain was, and the world was, what they did had ripples that went round the world. But many evangelicals, sadly, missed their moment. So within one generation, evangelicalism went from the single most decisive influence in Britain to being a small subculture. And you can see where Britain is today as people like Luis Palau have been there this last year. A very, very different place. Some seized their moment and most missed their moment. Now, as you look at the world today, this clearly is the second industrial revolution, the microchip and so on. And at this particular moment, there is no doubting that the United States is the world's lead society, for better or worse. And there's no doubting, as you look at America today in the 1980s, that the evangelical community, after the 70s, has come center stage and has the potential for being the most decisive religious community in America. My question to you simply is, will evangelical Christians today seize their moment as the best of them did 150 years ago? Or will they, like most of them did, miss that moment so that it passes from America? Now, the reason I say that simply is because many European Christians, as they look across at America now, would say that you are facing a most extraordinary opportunity and responsibility. Even, we would dare say, a biblical sense of kairos, hour. Let me try and share that with you this morning. Dean Acheson, when he was the Secretary of State just before he retired, was over in Europe talking to some leading Europeans. And he made the remark that the challenge of being an American statesman was how in the nuclear age to be the leader of a world power that was saddled with a constitution of an 18th century farmers' republic. In other words, he went on, how does America in the 20th century relate to its 18th century past? Now, in few modern nations is the past so recent and so proud and so prominent in national consciousness. And yet many people think in the 1980s that that relationship of the past to the present is crucially at stake in ways that are so much important that what comes out in the 1980s could be critical for America for decades to come. Now, the clearest symptom of this so-called turning point talk is the number of books that are all claiming that America is at a turning point. In the second half of the 1970s alone, more than 50 books came out, all claiming America is being restructured, America is being transformed, America is at a turning point. Some say economically, some say socially, some say politically, the realignment and so on. Various claims and candidates for what is this crucial American turning point. But interestingly, from a European perspective, one of the most obvious things is not just what they claim, but what they don't claim and what they crucially ignore. And the most obvious things that most of the claims at the national level ignore is simply the spiritual factor. For example, if you compare the 50s to the 80s, a very common comparison, the nostalgia, the return to traditional values, the same Republican administration, and so on and so on, the spiritual renewal. Many, many commentators at many levels point out the similarities between the 50s and the 80s, and there are many. But again, what is striking from a European perspective is not the similarities, which are often surface ones, but the differences which are far deeper. And no difference is greater than the place in public appreciation of the spiritual factor in America in the 80s compared with the 50s. In 1955, Eisenhower, in a speech to the Back to the God campaign for the American Legion, made the statement that God is the first and foremost component of Americanism. And for his pains, he was hailed by the Republican Party as the spiritual leader, not the political leader, the spiritual leader of our time, almost uncontested. Last summer in Dallas, when President Reagan made his speech at the prayer breakfast, he made remarks which, if you read the actual transcript itself, would have raised no eyebrows in any history class or any social science class, and yet was hailed a day or two later by the New York Times as a gross abuse of high office and extreme civic sin. And you can just think of the debate in the last 5 years to see the extraordinary difference between America in the 50s and the 80s. In many ways, the national consensus has been weakened to the point of collapse, so that much conservatism has been radicalized, and religion itself has been politicized in a way that would have been unthinkable 30 years earlier. Or if you just look at the way the press treat religion, either for long periods of time it's the nuisance factor, or it's just the non-issue that's never raised because it's not really important in the national discussions. But we would argue as Christians that it's far more than that. And certainly from a European perspective, you can see that if America is at a turning point, and I believe it is too, the most important factor in many ways is the one they ignore. It goes furthest back, it goes deepest down, and is so powerful and yet ignored that this is probably the most crucial factor of all, the way the spiritual issue is the most deep and decisive thing in the national and social issues in America at the moment. Now, let me just get into this whole discussion by raising, in the short time we have, just three areas that one could look at in more depth. And the first is to ask, what is the context of all this? The second is to raise the question, does the Christian community have the capacity to play any significant part anyway? And thirdly, to ask what would be the consequences, both for the faith and for the nation, as to how these issues are likely to come out in the next decade or two. First of all, though, what's the context of this recent discussion and this whole sense of a turning point and the question of the spiritual factor being part of the national and social issues? Now, if we had more time, the easiest way to be outlined this would be to show over the last 100 years, or the last 3 decades particularly, the way certain developments and trends have created this sense of turning point. But we haven't time for that, so instead of that, let me do a different way, to pick up 3 big themes that are being discussed at the national level, and yet to show you that if they're discussed in depth, the deepest issue is spiritual, and yet that's what's ignored in the national discussions. Let me just take 3 issues that are being raised by commentators and by academics and by many people at the levels of leadership, all of them crucially concerned with America in the 80s, and yet what many of these people don't see, which we can surely see very clearly, is that the most decisive component in the big issue is the spiritual factor. The first issue is, what is the status and strength of Americanism? Americanism. In the 1950s, James Baldwin, the novelist, went over to Paris, as he said, to escape America because he hated America. But to his surprise, he discovered, through experiencing culture shock, he learned what it was to eat French foods and go the French way of life and the French lifestyle and so on. He discovered in culture shock not only the Frenchness of the French, but, as he said, his own Americanness. So that after 6 months, Baldwin admitted, and he wrote a famous essay, he said, he discovered he was as American as any Texan GI. Now, Americanism is the unwritten and unspoken assumptions and values and perspectives of what it is to see and be American. Take any 100 Americans and say, what's as American as apple pie to you? And at first you get 100 different answers, and they'd include things like apple pie and hamburgers and Cokes and so on. And very mundane things are very important to the way people see their nations. But go far deeper than that, and you'd be working down to things like dynamism and enterprise and self-reliance and many of the myths and values that are very close to Americanism. But deepest down of all, of course, you'd be getting down to things that surround notions of the flag, notions of freedom, and supremely, attitudes to faith. Now, these are what I mean by Americanism. And no one can look at America without seeing that Americanism is unique in the world. No other nation has a set of notions quite like Americanism. And they've been profoundly important to America. I don't mean other nations don't have beliefs about the Frenchness and the Englishness and so on. Of course they do. But a set of notions quite like Americanism. For instance, this has been the key to the extraordinary sense of continuity in American history. So that America is both socially extremely progressive and yet morally extremely conservative until recently. If you were to compare the census of 1790 with the census of 1970, you can see extraordinary changes. The territory increased fourfold. The population density increased 13-fold. The population itself increased 52-fold. And in that time, America shifted from being a small, rural, small-town nation to being the world's leader in advanced industrial nations. Titanic changes, and yet remarkable continuity. And between those nearly 200 years, extraordinary stability and continuity, and most people who see it would say the secret is the underlying continuity of Americanism, the values and assumptions by which Americans understand America, supremely rooted in faith, among other things. And yet, in the last nearly 20 years, there have been more changes in those values and assumptions than in the previous nearly 200 years put together. And that's why I say the first question concerns the strength and status of Americanism. For instance, secular people would now challenge Eisenhower's statement that God is the first and foremost expression of Americanism. And in the public sphere today, the secularist challenge means that much of the religious dimension of Americanism has ruled out. So yes, the economic dimension, free enterprise, the social dimension, egalitarianism, those are intact. But the religious dimension, a belief in God and so on, is now ruled out as far as the public sphere is concerned. But not only that, many of those who strongly believe Americanism, in terms of rhetoric, do not practice many of its assumptions and values in terms of their lifestyle. Luis was giving examples last night. And you can think, even in the church, those who have the strongest beliefs in, say, the family and loyalty to the family are showing in their lifestyles and in practice today an adherence to that or a lack of adherence to that, which shows that what's traditionally been the cornerstone and bedrock of Americanism, such as the traditional family, is no longer believed in or practiced in the old ways. And you can see in many, many different points, in the last 20 years, both among those who are against certain things, as well as among those who are on the surface in favor of them but not practicing them, there has been more of a practical and theoretical challenge to Americanism than ever before. Well, take a second issue. The crisis of what's called exceptionalism. Exceptionalism. After World War II, many, many people, both in America and outside, said America is exceptional. She didn't have socialist movements, hostile ideological class divisions, and so on. Why? Because of the openness of the economy, the openness of the society, and so on, made America exceptional. As one German visitor put it, socialism always ran aground on the reefs of roast beef and apple pie for the people of plenty. Now, that was commonly said after World War II, but of course it went back to where? The Puritans. And exceptionalism began with the Puritans who came here with a sense of God's cause, which led them leave England and come here, or what they call the errand into the wilderness. So the groundings of that deep sense of exceptionalism were spiritual. Now other things were added. The economy added certain factors, history added certain factors, the wide open space of America added certain factors. But out of what was originally theological and spiritual with all these additional factors, there was this tremendous growth of a sense of exceptionalism which grew into destiny, which grew into manifest destiny. But the important thing is to see that this, until the 1960s, characterized almost all Americans. Some justified isolationism from exceptionalism. Some justified international involvement. Some were conservatives. Some were liberals. But almost all sectors of American society were characterized by what Henry Kissinger called the universal sense of American moral mission. And nothing is deeper and more central to the heart of America in the world than this profound sense of exceptionalism. Today, it's very much alive and well in certain circles, in most American hearts. And no president has been more gifted in recent history than the present president in conjuring up the American sound, as he called it. And yet, you can see, there is a crisis of exceptionalism. Much of the rest of the world now deeply resents it. And it's dangerous to be an American in certain parts of the world. But not only that, you can see there are key segments of your own society who not only do not believe it, who believe it's both wrong and dangerous. In other words, following Vietnam and all that that meant in terms of an overweening sense of destiny abroad, there are very significant parts of American society who do not want anything to do with the notion at all. Some say, even if you can justify it today, it's dangerous. Others say it can no longer be justified. And it's true that the foundations of American exceptionalism are no longer as strong as they were. For instance, the early Puritan notion that America was Israel is not justifiable theologically and is dangerous. And you can see that many of the economic grounds, the historical grounds, the geographical grounds are no longer true today. And at point after point after point, the things that set America apart from the rest of the world have disappeared, and there's only really two great points of difference left. The lesser one is migration, and the other I'll leave for the moment. And so there's today a genuine crisis of exceptionalism, which is alive in rhetoric, but much weaker in reality, which is bound to be very crucial to the way America goes on in the world, and absolutely central to that issue is the spiritual factor. Or one other issue being raised. The so-called crisis of public philosophy. There is a tremendous debate today. Does America need a public philosophy? In other words, that your nation is so open, so diverse. No nation in the world is more diverse in terms of ethnic backgrounds, religious allegiances, language diversity, and so on. No nation is so diverse, so open, and so free. So the question is raised, does America not need some public philosophy, some common faith for the common good? Now, as this debate rages in certain areas today, there is enormous disagreements, but almost unanimity on two points. On the one hand, that America used to be a republic with a working model of a public philosophy. In other words, from the Puritans who believed in a covenant, right down to the late 1950s sense of traditional consensus, there was an extraordinary binding common faith that built the common good and was the public philosophy. But equally, there's almost no disagreement today, on the other hand, that that has collapsed. Whether it's agreement about what constitutes a family or what constitutes foreign policy, America today faces a radical diversity that is bordering on radical relativism that threatens to pull apart any sense of consensus, let alone in some instances, agreement. Lippmann was one of the first to see this and gave the name public philosophy back in the 1920s. He pointed out its impact on public opinion. Public opinion in a democracy, he said, would be dangerous and majoritarian unless it had a public philosophy above it to curb it. And you can see today with all the single issue groups and so on, the reason to his warning and the chaos at the moment. Other people have applied this to the public schools or to higher education or to law. And across the board, people are seeing that the collapse of the traditional consensus, the disappearance of a public philosophy, leaves America pulled in all sorts of ways with a dangerous vacuum at the heart of the republic. Now, of course, you get into each of these three great issues and you see immediately that each of them has an inescapable spiritual component. What was the strongest source, not the only one, but the strongest source of Americanism? Faith. What was the key contribution to exceptionalism? Faith. And what was the strongest background factor in the public philosophy? Faith. And in each case, either because faith is being denied by certain people in the public sphere, or is not being practiced on the ground by those who profess to practice it, you can see that America is crucially at a turning point, and the spiritual factor is absolutely key to the way America goes. Let me move on quickly to the second question. Does the Christian community have the capacity at this moment to play any significant part? As you look at America from any other part of the world, one's heart is torn in two ways. Because on the one hand, something extraordinary is happening here by comparison with almost all other countries. And on the other hand, so many Americans are caught up and mesmerized by what is happening that they don't perceive the deep weaknesses that are also happening. So that today, despite the surface strengths of the Christian community, I have to say to you with sadness, I know no significant observer of the American scene, including Christians, who think that in 20 years' time, evangelicalism will be playing the part that its numbers and its opportunities today would lead you to expect. How could one sum this up? Clearly what is happening here is absolutely exceptional. And when American exceptionalism is declining at point after point, religion is the last great exception to the decline of exceptionalism. Look back over American history to see it one way. There have been two low points, spiritually speaking. One was the revolutionary decade in the 1770s. The other was the 1930s, when Protestantism collapsed in terms of its old cultural strength. But since the 1930s, all the statistical indicators, with only a few exceptions, have slowly but steadily mounted, with a slight hiccup of difference in the 60s. So that today it is perfectly possible to argue with tough statistics, which I won't bore you with this morning, that there are more Christians in America today than ever before. That they have more money at their disposal than ever before. They're in positions of greater leadership in business, in politics, and many other places than ever before, with organs of communication and technologies stronger and more efficient and powerful than ever before. All those sorts of facts you could easily argue when you look back and compare it with the American past. Equally, you could say that America is exceptional today by comparison with any other country in the modernized world. In the 1770s, countries like Sweden were at the top of the league tables, religiously speaking. America, interestingly, in those days, was at the bottom. Today, the picture is reversed. In almost every statistic, Sweden and France are down at the bottom, whereas America is either one or second or third in every single statistic. And if she's not nudged out of first place in some statistics, it's usually not by the highly advanced industrial nations, it's by some of the more backward ones, like countries in the Eastern Bloc, like Poland, or countries in Western Europe, like Ireland, which are rather different. But no other Western, highly advanced industrial nation has any place for religion that rivals in any way the place that it has in the United States. One could put it like this. In every country in the world that's highly advanced, the more modern they've become, the less religious they've become. And yet America is stubbornly different as being the most modernized country in the world and at the same time the most religious of highly modern countries in the world. Or another way of putting it would be this. In every country in the world, the tendency has been that as education has increased, religious affiliation has dropped. But the United States has both the highest standards of formal education and the highest levels of formally attested belief. You have levels of attested belief on a par with the least literate Asian and African countries. In other words, what is happening here, both in religion in general in the United States, but certainly in the Christian church in particular, what is happening here is utterly exceptional, quite extraordinary, by the standards of all the other modern countries in the world, of staggering significance. Now, shouldn't need to underline that in a conference of pastors and so on. But you can see that that fact is not on the table in terms of your national discussion. And the reasons are obvious. Firstly, it's totally against the European experience. And most people think that as Europe, so the United States, and America is totally different. The second reason is that this is totally against the expectations and the assumptions of the key elites in America, supremely the academic world, and the press and media. Some of these people are maliciously against the gospel. Many of them are not. They just do not have either the expectations or the assumptions to even see, let alone understand, what is happening. And some of them are the most surprised people on earth to discover that their own fellow Americans are the most religious people on earth. The third reason we need to say this nationally is that this, of course, is not the image of America being exported around the world. Nowhere is the gap between the American image and the American reality greater than at the point of religion. The world thinks of you not in terms of your ideals or the realities of what's on the ground. Why? Because you have shifted from selling yourself from ideals to images. So the world thinks of you in terms of things like hamburgers and Cokes and Dallas and Dynasty and Knott's Landing and all the various programs that are shown, all of which have a total blind spot in terms of any reality of religion. So the world, by and large, has no understanding of how genuinely religious America is in reality. So clearly, on the one hand, what is happening here is quite exceptional and extraordinary by any standards in history or compared with other parts of the world. And yet, because it's so different, it seems tragically obvious to those from the outside that many American Christian leaders do not see the deep weaknesses that are here, and there's almost a kind of complacency, if not a triumphalism, based on the differences, that is blinding people to the deep realities of the weaknesses. Let me just take one simple example, and you can add in everything Louise said last night. Just take the dilution of discipleship in America. The fact is that all the statistical indicators are up, as any Gallup poll will show you. But as George Gallup also hammers home, the social influence of the gospel is actually down. And one of the main reasons is that as people, either theologically or sociologically, have examined the shape of faith in practice, not profession, there is a deep dilution of faith, which means that there is an extraordinary weakness which will eventually show through with drastic social consequences. One simple illustration. The late founder and president of McDonald's Hamburgers was a delightful Christian. Interviewed by the New York Times, they asked him what he believed in. He remarked, "I believe in God, the family, and McDonald's Hamburgers. And when I get to the office, I reverse the order." Now, we'll trust he's being facetious. The New York Times report didn't pick that up. But let's hope he was. But even if he was, what he was saying is what millions of Christians do every day without realizing it. I believe in God, the family, McDonald's Hamburgers, and when I get to the office, I reverse the order. In other words, in America, as one observer puts it, Christianity today is privately engaging, but socially irrelevant. It flourishes in the free time world, in the home, in the church, during the weekend, and so on. But when people go back to McDonald's, back to the Pentagon, back to IBM, back to Xerox, back to Bechtel, you name it, they go to a different world with different ways. Unwittingly, they hang their faith with their hat and coats at the door. So certainly Christians don't sleep around with their secretaries or whatever. Certainly they don't swear and so on at the Christmas parties or whatever. But does their Christian faith infiltrate the way the work is done, the way the employees are treated, the way the third world implications are worked out? In very, very few cases. And there is a deep dilution of faith, which incidentally studies have shown starts in the pulpit and goes right out into the public sphere. So the statistical indicators are up, but the social influence is actually down. 100 years ago, Victorian Christianity was booming. English Christians compared themselves with Christians in France, and thank God they were different. They didn't see their weaknesses, and today we Christians in England are a little better off, but some better off, than Christians in France. You are at that same situation. You can easily look elsewhere in the world and see the extraordinary differences. But unless you look to the very significant weaknesses which go right to the heart of the nature of the gospel itself and run from preaching right out to discipleship, you can see that in 100 years, you or your descendants may be where we tragically are in Europe today. And as I said, I know no major observer of the Christian community who thinks that evangelicalism, for all its numbers and its opportunity today, will have the impact in 20 years which you'd expect, because they've seen the deep dilution and deficiencies that are characterizing discipleship in the modern world. Let me move on to the third question. What would be the consequences, both for the faith and the nation, as to how these things work out? In very few modern countries is the spiritual factor even a factor. If you read the British government statistical yearbook, the church is next to camping. Not because they both begin with C, but because both are in the leisure categories. And about the same number of people go to church in Britain as are members of sewing circles. So naturally, apart from certain state church things, you don't expect religious factor to be a deeply important national factor. But in America, it is. Which means that as faith goes in America, so the nation goes one way or another. Either the presence of faith strongly, or the absence of faith strongly and suddenly, will make an extraordinary difference in America in ways it wouldn't make in any other nation. I'm not making any predictions. I don't believe in predictions for both theological and other reasons, and I believe we're in for a day when people will make any number of bad predictions, either spiritual or secular. In fact, I believe the only safe prediction you can make today is that we're about to see an extraordinary rash of false predictions. So what I'm saying now is not a prediction. Having said that, thinkers who are seeing the place of faith now and the way it's likely to go see there are only certain broad possible outcomes in terms of the American futures. Let me just mention the four most likely directions to you. The first possibility is that you'll move towards a liberal secular tomorrow. People who back this direction do not see either that religion will disappear or that secularism will be dominant. Both of those are extremely unlikely. As this scenario sees it, you could even have more religious believers than you have today. But the key thing is their faith would be privately engaging, socially irrelevant. So you would have a liberal secular umbrella over an extremely pluralistic religious situation with millions and millions of Christians whose faith is so privately engaging, socially irrelevant, that it made no national difference. Now, of course, this future is backed by many in the academic world, many in the press and media, and it's also backed by millions of Christians whose faith is so privately engaging that it has no national significance. So there are millions of Christians who unwittingly are putting their shoulders to this first possible scenario. Now, clearly this one would be not only a tragedy for the gospel, I needn't comment on that, but so many Christians at such a moment in history would be so ineffective, would be a tragedy for the gospel of prime proportions. Probably also, this first scenario would be self-defeating for the nation. The key question America would face under this first scenario would secularism in the public sphere provide sufficient strength to bed traditional values once religion is no longer doing it? Now, many secular thinkers will say, of course it will. Look at the deep concern in the 80s for values. This shows you how deeply interested people are in values, even traditional values, even in a day when you have more secular people in certain areas. We mustn't be taken in by that. There is a deep concern with values, but how deep does it really go? Read many of the commentaries on this. You'll notice that much of the concern is not with convictions, it's with circumstances. So people dropped out in the 60s and didn't practice their Protestant work ethic, but that was because they were so wealthy. And yes, people got back to work in the 70s and are still hard back to work in the 80s, but is that because of a revival of a genuine appreciation of the conviction of work? Far from it. It's the socioeconomic conditions which constrain them to do so, and that may be good or bad, but it's nothing to do with genuine values and convictions. It's much more a matter of circumstances. And so much of the value craze is like that too. Or take a second weakness of it. You see, much of the concern with values today is a concern with the styles in which they're worn, not the substance of the values. So books have come out to show whether Americans are emulators or behaviors, and how do Americans pick up, and how do they wear, and how do they drop and pass on their values? Because they're matters of fashion and trends and styles. Now, is that traditional values which gave Americanism its extraordinary continuity over 200 years? Of course not. The third great weakness is that much of this concern with values is concerned with market values. Sadly, even in much evangelism and Christian work too. In other words, the bottom line is the bottom line. And they're out to see the market values and the expectations and the preferences, because if you want to sell a product or sell a politician, you need to know the values of where people are. But that is not traditional values, and it's a far cry from Christian values. So for reasons like that, I would say this first scenario is a tragedy for the gospel and will probably be self-defeating for the nation. The second scenario is one that sees crisis and decline. Not lurid decadence, not dramatic catastrophe, but just slow crisis and decline. In other words, as the spiritual and moral underpinnings of the social order are removed, eventually there will be social consequences, as you can see in other parts of the world, supremely in Britain. Now again, the secularists will say, nonsense. Even if there is no strong religious morality in public, you will have things like technology, you will have law holding it together. And we must again say prophetically, these things will not be enough. Will technology be a substitute for morals? Of course not. For one thing, it's so frail. For another thing, technology is increasing moral problems, not solving them. Take the healthcare problems, take genetic engineering. We need stronger morals to answer the problems technology is raising. But above all, technology does not deal with sin. Evil is irrational. And those who think that by technology, from computer surveillance to traffic lights, can create a world so technologically controlled that no one will get away with evil, are really going to be surprised. Above all, who will control the controllers? Technology will never be a substitute for morality. And those humanists and secular thinkers who think it will are in for a rude shock, and it would have national consequences. But nor will law. Do you not see today in America that as morality decreases, law is increasing? Litigation is growing so much that you have 6% of the world's population and 66% of the world's lawyers. And law is becoming one of the greatest instruments of vengeance, money-making, and injustice, even among Christians in America today, as in other parts of the country. And you can see it just as it was in the days of Amos, that when people desert God, litigation spreads like a poisonous weed. America will be cursed by its law if it leaves faith and morality. This is why the second scenario sees what George Will calls the slow barbarization of the republic from within, or what Henry Kissinger has called the spiritual void in America. The third scenario is one that sees traditional values imposed by authoritarian means. In other words, rather than drift towards decline, people will impose traditional values not because they're true or right, but because they're useful. Now, in the long run, the real danger in the 1990s and so on will be things like we're watching tonight. That you'll see an alliance between the new consciousness and the new class and what remains of the new left. But that's in the long run. In the short run, where does the danger come from? It comes from the manipulation of the gospel. In other words, if you were a manipulating politician, who today provides the best candidate for social glue in America? You wouldn't pick the Eastern religions, Rajneesh, or any of them. Why? There aren't enough of them. You wouldn't pick liberal theology for two very simple non-theological factors. One is it doesn't appeal to ordinary people. The other is, which liberal theology? It changes so fast, it wouldn't be any good. There is only one serious candidate in America for social glue, conservative Christianity. For good reasons. It appeals to ordinary people. It has historical resonance in American history, but also for bad reasons. It has a proven track record for bolstering cultures under stress. Look at South Africa today. Look at Ulster today. Look at the south of the United States recently. In other words, you understand why there are certain politicians who see the usefulness of conservative Christianity. In 1980, when I was doing some interviewing for the BBC over here, I interviewed one of your right-wing strategists, kicked off his shoes and leant back and laughed. He said, "You want to know what I really believe?" And pointed up to a picture on the wall of a guru. And then he began to describe to the director and me, and the director happened to be an evangelical too, how for 5 years he'd been out to win and to woo the fundamentalists and the evangelicals because they were absolutely key to secular right-wing strategy. Now, I'm not saying for a moment that sometimes the concerns of the gospel don't overlap with the left and don't overlap with the conservatives and the right. I'm not saying that for a moment. But on the other hand, there are some who are cynically, deliberately out to manipulate. And there are many Christians caught up with a hunger for power and many other things who are vulnerable and ripe for that manipulation today. And it leads precisely towards this third scenario, which in the long run does not work for the nation, and in the short and long run is a disaster for the gospel. Which leaves only one more scenario, and that is the fourth one. There'll be a genuine revitalization of the American way of life and values through genuine revival and reformation. I think today it would have to be reformation as well as revival. But as much of what passes for revival is often just promoted, organized evangelism. Much of what passes for renewal is really kind of suburban freedom that is a long way short of genuine biblical revival. But just notice two things about this fourth scenario. On the one hand, it's the hardest. The Lord primarily has to do it. But not only that, Christians would have to recover the lordship of Christ over every inch of their lives, over McDonald's as well as the church, as it were. They'd have to do something which Christians in almost no other part of the highly modern world have done. This is the hardest scenario. And on the other hand, it's the most tempting. Tempting simply because those who love Christ and their country are tempted to do the right thing for the wrong reason. But if we work and pray for this scenario to save the West, or to hold together democracy, or for America's sake, it is not the fourth scenario. It's unwittingly the third. Seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things will be added. And you can see in the day of the new patriotism, the new era of good feelings and so on, many people's love for their country and for the faith are so closely tied together now that the confusion is dangerous. And one wonders how many have a single eye for the glory of the Lord and for the righteousness of the kingdom, or how much of it's tied in with other things. Not openly, not crassly, not manipulative, but so subtly that in the long run it would be pulled off course. With all my heart, I believe that you in America today are where England was 150 years ago. Some seized their moment. Many missed it. And you visit England today, and we need more like Luis and others coming over to preach the gospel. So tough is the situation today. Don't count on your being where you are today in 20 years' time, let alone 120 years' time. Because not only the nation is at a turning point, the Christian community is at a very key turning point. Look at it positively and say, what the Christian community does will be crucially decisive in affecting what America does. And because America is number one in the world at this point, it will be crucial for world history. Look at it more negatively, and you can see that the church, shaped by the culture, eventually becomes weak in ways that are socially decisive for itself and socially decisive for its culture. And America, in our grandchildren's time, will be able to tell the difference. Jesus, on that Palm Sunday, looked out over Jerusalem. Many people just saw a hot, hazy spring afternoon. Many people just saw the enthusiastic crowds proclaiming their Messiah. Jesus saw through the day, saw through the expectations and enthusiasm of his contemporaries. He saw down to AD 70 and what would flow from what they were choosing that day. And as he saw what they were missing, he wept. Remember it said of David's men that they were skilled in reading the signs of the times to discover what course Israel should follow. You remember Jeremiah dismissed the Pharaoh of his day. He was King Bombast, the man who missed his moment. Jesus wept over his contemporaries because they missed God's moment when it came. I just urge you with all my heart, throughout all your lives and all your ministries, so live and so minister in the light of the fact that you could be living in the American hour. By God's grace, recognize it, and by God's grace, seize it.